How can we design spaces that make us measurably healthier, happier, and more productive? Join us on Built for Health, where we talk with public health professionals, researchers, and AEC practitioners on the latest knowledge and strategies to design, build, and operate healthier buildings. I'm Flavia Gray. I'm a Schneider Fellow at USGBC, and I'll be your host on Built for Health, brought to you by USGBC. Hello, and welcome to Built for Health. I'm your host, Flavia Gray, and in today's episode, we'll discuss nutrition and food production with Christopher Grallert from Green City Growers and special guest Dr. Michael Greger from nutritionfacts.org. They will tell us about their professional journeys, the connection between nutrition and health outcomes, some strategies for on-site local food production, and how edible landscapes can support your environmental goals.
Tell us a little bit about who you are and what your background is.
My name is Dr. Michael Greger. I'm a general practitioner specializing in clinical nutrition. I'm a founding member fellow of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine and run an organization called nutritionfacts.org, which is a free nonprofit science-based public service providing daily updates on the latest in nutrition research via bite-sized videos, more than 1,000 videos on nearly every aspect of healthy eating, with new videos and articles uploaded every day on the latest in evidence-based nutrition.
Dr. Greger, what is the connection between nutrition and health outcomes?
Well, according to the Global Burden of Disease study, this is the largest study on risk factors for human disease in history, funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the number one cause of death in the United States is the American diet. Number one cause of disability in terms of number of healthy years of life lost is our diet. Cigarettes now only kill about 500,000 Americans every year, whereas our diet kills hundreds of thousands more. So the most important thing we can do for our health is what we put in our mouth, basically food and cigarettes.
That is incredible, and I think a lot of people are not aware of this. And so what are some of the main issues with our diets?
Well, we are not eating enough healthy foods, which are, whole plant foods. So we're talking about fruits, vegetables, legumes, flippies, chickpeas, lentils, beans, whole grains, nuts and seeds, mushrooms, herbs, and spices. Basically, real food that grows out of the ground. That's what we need to be eating more of.
Awesome. So what are some of the benefits of just including more fresh and vegetables in our diets?
That same Gold Burden of Disease study calculated that the number one dietary risk factor for death, like if you had to think of what kills more people on this planet from diet, you'd think, I don't know, maybe soda, processed meat, something like that. No, inadequate fruit consumption kills more people than any other dietary risk factor. Worldwide, if humanity just ate more fruit, they estimate we would save 4.9 million lives a year, nearly 5 million lives hanging in the balance, and their salvation isn't some new drug or vaccine. It may just be more fruit and vegetables, 1.8 million lives. Not quite up to fruit level, but certainly one of the healthiest things we can eat.
That's incredible, and one would expect that fruit is sweet. We love, so we would be eating more of that.
Right, so it's like the best of both worlds. Tastes great, and you get to live longer. That's what eating plant-based diets is all about.
And so what are the obstacles? Why are people not eating enough fresh produce?
Oh, I think people just don't understand the power that produce has. I mean, you're never going to see an ad on, the Super Bowl for sweet potatoes or something. I mean, there's just no money to be made. They're not patentable. You can't trademark. I mean, even a broccoli grower isn't going to put an ad on TV for broccoli because you'll just buy their competitor's broccoli, right? I mean, it's perishable. There's just not a lot of markup. What you want is, something that sits on the shelf forever, good for shelf life, not good for human life. The healthiest foods, people don't know how healthy they are. And so that's one thing. Also, You know, accessibility is another issue. You know, you hear about these so-called food deserts. They're actually not food deserts. There's food there, but it's just horrible food, right? So they're like food swamps, really, right? All this processed garbage, which is self-stable, but not enough fresh produce. So we need a solution.
Well, Christopher, I think you're part of the solution. So why don't you tell us about, you know, urban agriculture, what do you guys do?
Yeah, so at Green City Growers, what we're up to is taking unused commercial, municipal spaces, residential spaces, and converting them into vibrant production areas located in, you know, spaces that have otherwise been underutilized or not used at all. Sort of the idea of a distributed production agriculture, you know, to Dr. Greger's point about accessibility and a lack of knowledge, you know, when people get engaged in urban farming or urban gardening, it's an experience that most of us haven't had. I, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I grew up working on a mixed vegetable operation, but I'm sort of the exception. You know, at the turn of the last century, you know, over 90% of the population of the United States was involved in agriculture or food production in one way or another. You know, currently it's less than 2%. Food production has become isolated to large production areas in the desert Southwest and in the San Joaquin Valley in California. And I'm talking about fruits and vegetables, specifically Florida and places like that. So coming up with concepts around developing distributed food production models is what we're all about. So we work with anywhere from a couple raised beds at someone's home in suburban Boston area to large production infrastructure, in-ground farms for restaurant chains, rooftop farms for supermarkets. And we certainly get a lot of attention. We have a rooftop farm at Fenway Park where the Boston Red Sox play. And that has currently knocked off over 30% of their outside fresh produce procurement. So we're producing over 30% of their fresh produce needs, and it's served in the concessions at the private boxes and other food service concessions. So it's all about engagement. What we're doing is bringing people in from all walks of life. We have programming around preschool, kindergarten age children, all the way up through high school, young professionals at corporate campuses where we have garden infrastructure, through senior living facilities where right up through memory care, we'll have sensory gardens and things like that that engage the constituency in all different levels of gardening activity.
Have you made any connections with hospitals?
Yeah, we have. That's an interesting question. So one of my first experiences in understanding the impact that this sort of programming has was we were doing an installation for the Whittier Health Center in Boston, in the Roxbury neighborhood in Boston. And I went to do the installation with the crew, and some of the people coming out of the hospital started asking questions. Can you grow these certain things here? You can grow broccoli and beans, and we were planting fruit trees, and they were amazed. And it, you know, again, having grown up working in farming and spending my whole life in agriculture, I had that experience, and you know, it's a significant part of who I am. But to have individuals coming out in an urban area and seeing what we're doing, and the amazement and astonishment at what's possible in a very tight space, it was pretty neat. So yes, we work with a few different healthcare organizations.
That's fantastic. We need it.
Yeah, I really think there's a huge opportunity for on-site food production, and you know, we're at the beginnings of this. You know, I always say local is not new. There, local production was around until just, you know, the Green Revolution started to, you know, transportation after World War II, the Green Revolution and these sorts of things began began to consolidate and scale these production areas into large, you know, monocropping systems. Prior to that, you know, here in the Boston area or any large metropolitan area in very, you know, near locations were mixed vegetable operations, truck farms, market gardens that were providing, you know, 30 or 40 different kinds of crops to the local markets, you know. And as our transportation systems and logistical systems and storage systems and the progression of crop inputs and crop machinery and mechanization happened, these you know, these operations went away. The seasonality is shorter in the Northeast, for example, than it is in the desert Southwest in California. And, you know, it speaks to what you were mentioning before, Dr. Greger, where the, you know, lack of access and convenience of these sorts of things, you know, went away. So these local farms went away. And so we see ourselves, you know, there's a future to this concept of distributed production for food. You know, we're talking with people who want to grow grains locally, who want to grow grains on rooftops, who want to do more things, indoor systems. You know, our technology, what we're doing is fairly robust. We're using, you know, organic soil production systems where we are taking, you know, agricultural systems that have been used for, you know, millennia, essentially, and putting them in spaces that haven't normally been used for food production. So as technology moves forward with these sorts of systems, as well as other things like indoor production systems and things like that, you know, distributed production agriculture, as I characterize it, will become much more of a reality. And, you know, it's not stopping. The, you know, the consumers want it. Society wants it. People like Dr. Greger are, you know, very effectively promoting the importance of these sort of things. And so we feel like, you know, we don't know what it's going to look like in 5 or 10 years from now, but it's going to be really, really cool.
Oh, an important point of what you're saying is the fact that people don't know anymore where their food comes from. And so for them, it becomes, you know, what do you mean? Don't tomatoes, like, just appear in the supermarket? Vegetables? Yeah.
It's a great point, Flavia. And I think, you know, that's an extreme situation where people assume, really the reality is people have not given it consideration. And when I first started working professionally in the fresh produce business, the consumer was very fickle, particularly in the United States, about, you know, where they're, you know, they just were not giving a lot of attention. That's changed. People now want to know where their food has come from. They want to know who's produced the food. They want to know that it was produced safely and that the workers were treated fairly and that the, you know, the impact on the environment is being minimalized, and there's a process to reduce, you know, the environmental impact, you know. And so, but back to that really cool thing, that magic that happens when people get into a garden space that have not experienced it before. And it's wonderful and it's magical. And there's all, you know, there's evidence now that, and, you know, Dr. Greger, one of the things that we're really curious about is what sort of empirical evidence is starting to become available that speaks to the recuperative and therapeutic values of working in with soil and working in different growing systems or producing your own fruits and vegetables. So it's impactful when you're at a corporate campus and people who have are accustomed to going to the cafe in the corporate campus or are, you know, sitting in their cubicle or don't have a lot of activities, and an option becomes available for them to work with a young urban farmer in a garden space producing organic vegetables on site. It's pretty cool and pretty amazing.
Yeah, well, there's certainly data on, you know, getting kids involved in gardening, these school-based programs, increasing their fruit and vegetable consumption. And so that's certainly exciting. I was just wondering, Christopher, if you're worried about kind of legacy lead contamination in urban kind of environments.
Sure. I mean, we do heavy metal testing on all sites we're going to go into, and if there's any indication that lead has been an issue, we would generally replace the soil. So it's a soil, organic soil blend from a local compost producer that we use on all of our sites or another compost producer in Vermont called Compost. And Brick Ends Farm is another local compost producer that we use here at Green City Growers. And so There's lead abatement is a difficult issue. So in other words, there aren't cropping systems as of yet to remove the lead from the soil. So it's generally going to be in a raised bed environment or a soil replacement above a sort of horticultural fabric, which has been done in the city before, you know.
Chris, so we wanted to ask you, you know, what are the minimum requirements? How much space should be done in every climate? How do we get people to start growing their own food?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the first step is getting, you know, the constituency on board. And people who have gardened before or have a particular interest in food systems are going to be candidates that are going to be more open to figuring out how to get some infrastructure installed. But really, it's fairly basic, and you don't need a lot of space, and you'd be surprised where we could put food production systems. I mean, we have herb production systems at small restaurants that are, you know, sort of 20 square feet and are providing all of the organic mint that's required for all of their mint smoothies for the entire a standard type garden that could engage 20 or so participants can be, you know, sort of 200 square feet. And that, you know, will produce up to, you know, depending on the different crops that are grown in it, but potentially up to 1,000 pounds a year of fresh fruits and vegetables. And that can feed a few people. And then, of course, we have very large infrastructure that are producing multiple thousands of pounds of produce. Every season has been a leveling up and an improvement, and we're learning a lot. And it's, you know, it's really exciting. So the basic elements, though, of installing on-site food production is sunlight and water, really. And so, you know, with a minimal amount of space, as long as we're getting, you know, to try to produce fruiting crops like peppers and tomatoes and things like that, we really want to have six and a half hours of good sunlight. And then, you know, what you want to do is have accessibility to water to be able to irrigate, particularly with vegetables. You know, trying to hand water and have a successful crop is can be challenging. So a minimal amount of space required for, you know, a standard corporate campus. So food service or retailing is going to potentially require more if they're trying to service service restaurants. And so, again, we do everything from small raised beds, modular systems that are movable, all the way through to very intensive rooftop systems that where the planting media actually covers the roof, you know, at a depth of 8 to 12 inches, and you're planting a crop directly on top of it. And, you know, we also incorporate into these systems a program, a department in our in Green City Growers called Ecoscaping, where in, as opposed to bringing in imported species that have been grown in greenhouses in Florida and or are non-native, we put together a bloom chart and a planting palette, but using native species. And we do this on the ground and on rooftops where we're, you know, promoting the biodiversity by planting pollinator gardens or wildflower meadows or species of plants, both perennial bushes through annual plants that would be native to this, historically to this area or the area where we have the garden infrastructure. So it's sort of a comprehensive approach to landscaping, if you will.
I love it because these are repetitive themes that we find in the green building industry. You know, we're talking about green roofs, we talk about landscapes. And so how do you see these landscapes supporting the sustainability efforts of the building owners and people who want to get certified and have a green building?
I guess I'm the consummate optimist, and my glass is always half full, and I believe in the goodness of human nature. And I feel like, you know, that when it comes to building projects or real estate development projects or new projects that are going on with property management companies, there's a lot more consideration that's going into environmental sustainability. People are more conscientious, and you know, quite frankly, the tenancy and the, you know, the occupants of the buildings are very curious about these sorts of things as well, and are supporting and promoting these sorts of things. So, you know, there are great benefits environmentally to having these kinds of infrastructure in place. So aside from the fact that it look, you know, as LEED moves toward I think there's some pilot credits now in the LEED, the current version of LEED, you know, for on-site food production. There's also huge benefits for the sustainability of, you know, for things like air quality and reducing water runoff and stormwater management, you know, energy conservation, you know, mitigating heat island effects that happen when areas large areas are covered with pavement. You know, the temperature differential rises significantly 10 to 15 degrees. And when you have options to put green spaces in and food production in, you know, you mitigate that sort of stuff. When it's on a rooftop, in a rooftop or above ground situation, again, all of those aspects are included in the environmental sustainability, but as well as things like improving the life of the roof membrane, reducing noise, reducing, you know, heat, energy, you know, energy efficiency for the building. And all of this, you know, has a great impact on habitat for insects and wildlife and the ecology around these spaces. So I think it's wonderful that developers and real estate companies and asset holders are really seriously incorporating into their philosophies environmental sustainability, and these on-site food production and ecological landscaping play a significant role in this.
So Chris, when you're working with design teams and, you know, architects, engineers, at what stage in the design do you want to be involved to help them have edible landscapes on their projects?
The best time to get involved with the design teams or architects or asset holders is as early on in the process as possible. So much of the resources are allocated early on that to have a understanding of what the requirements are when you're installing green roof infrastructure in particular. Ground-based systems are gonna be a little bit less complex, but you certainly wanna allocate space and build your design around how that might be incorporated, whether it be near the food service concession if you're gonna use the food on site, or an area that's gonna have water access, you know, egress, and sunlight availability. So, but early on in the design process is best case scenario, because, you know, ultimately adding the additional infrastructure that will support on-site food production and ecological landscaping is not going to add significantly more resources, capital resources. There is, you know, there's you know, capital expenditure up front, particularly for rooftop systems. They are not inexpensive, but there is a lot of benefits that can be sort of calculated into the cost benefits of doing it. More challenging sites are sites that where you're retrofitting a building, like we did at Fenway Park. This is challenging because the engineering expense, oftentimes in older buildings, the design work is not there, and then just quite simply doing the construction work to make a roof that's going to be able to hold, you know, if it's an intensive system where we're putting planting media on top of the roof, you know, it can be up to an additional 75 pounds or more per square foot in addition to snow load requirement. So as early as possible into the design process is where we like to be.
And my other question was, what are the main barriers for adoption beyond, there's the maintenance costs for sure, and you were saying, you know, there's the climate, like you were talking about the snow load as well. And so a lot of people think that it's snowy weather, you know, you shouldn't be able to grow food.
Yeah, well, so that's a good question. I mean, so the obvious, you know, barriers and hurdles and concerns to doing something like this is the upfront capital expenditure to install the infrastructure, right? And then certainly there are ongoing maintenance and programming fees associated with this that are going to be difficult to you know, justify based on the amount of food production, quite frankly. But there's all kinds of other intangible benefits, including the value of the crop, but also the engagement with the constituency, whatever they may be. And so, for example, in property management today, there is such enthusiasm for it because of the engagement of the constituency at whether it's residential or corporate, and as well as senior living facilities. So look, beyond that, there's questions around where policy will go. Currently, there's very little policy in this area anyway, supporting on-site food production or urban agriculture. That's changing rapidly. For example, in Washington, D.C., where you are located, Flavia, they just recently created some new policy to make it really, really advantageous to use rooftop space for green space, whether it be non-edible or edible landscaping. So there's a lot more interest there. And large organizations, again, are much more committed to sustainability from all the way through from, you know, large, you know, private equity organizations, you know, speaking to the fact that they'll only be investing in green companies that have, you know, have a sort of a triple bottom line or a strong sustainability program in their philosophy. And so, the, you know, the costs up front, the ongoing maintenance and programming, I think are the biggest hurdles. You know, there are ways to do season extension. You mentioned there, you know, some constraints around having a short season. I think, you know, we are in one of the more challenging areas. But, you know, for example, last year, say in 2017, we probably on many sites where we have season extension, whether it be coal frames or some sort of protected horticulture environment that we can use, from greenhouses to coal frames to row covers and things like this. In many areas, we were harvesting vegetables for about 10 months. And so, you know, we can extend kind of our three cropping cycles here in the Northeast by using season extension. Beyond that, there's going to be, as the technology progresses, and we currently are managing indoor production systems, there are organic systems for both soil and hydroponics, where the technology is advancing rapidly, and we foresee in the near future, and I mean 5 or 7 years, there's going to be very robust technology for season extension, you know, season extension that makes sense year round. You know, a neat part of this kind of season extension is not only will it be productive from, so from a supply, an aspect of supplying food to the constituency, but it also has a huge engagement piece, and it speaks to this whole thing of getting people more involved once again in where their food's coming from. Now, there's been such a huge disconnect over time, and you know, so we're these sorts of systems, whether they be outdoors on the ground or rooftop or indoor systems, are a strong influence on getting people re-engaged in the food production systems.
Exactly. We're educating them. We're getting them to do exercise. It has the stress relief effect that you were talking about. So it's, you know, all around benefits. Chris, what are some resources or recommendations that you have for the people in our audience who want to learn more?
Yeah. If you want to learn more about urban farming and on-site food production, please take a minute to check out our website, www.greencitygrowers.com. We're also on Instagram as well, and so you're welcome to check us out and inquire within anytime.
Perfect, exactly. And so for those who want to learn more, they can come and check out your website.
Yes.
Great. And of course, on Dr. Gregory's behalf, they should check out nutritionfacts.org.
It was a pleasure to talk to Christopher Grallert from Green City Growers and special guest Dr. Michael Greger from nutritionfacts.org. They explained how including more fruits and vegetables into our diets can save millions of lives, the minimum requirements for growing food on site, and how urban agriculture supports green building efforts. To learn more, check out the Local Food Production Credit in the LEED Credit Library and the food-related courses on the education platform at usgbc.org, including Urban Agriculture and Community Food Systems and Everything is Food, Nutrient Systems for Cities and Buildings. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Built for Health by USGBC. Now we want to hear from you. What was your favorite part of today's episode? What are your best practices and strategies? Share with us on Facebook or Twitter at USGBC. To learn more, visit our website at usgbc.org. Thanks for listening.